Hey, Anna, scale of 1 to 10, how much do you love talking about young political leaders?
15.
Wow. Anthony, scale of 1 to 10, how much do you love martinis?
45%.
That's 4.5.
I mean, 45. I'm so dumb.
And I would say scale of 1 to 10, how much do I like doing both of those things? I'd say like a 4.5. But with you clowns, I've got to move it to a 9.5.
Only I'm the only one who went over the limit.
Because you're an overachiever. This is Political Playlist Happy Hour.
The political revolution of the millennials.
Welcome to political Playlist.
All right. Are you ready, guys?
Happy Hour.
Happy Hour. We fucked that up so bad.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Political Playlist Happy Hour. I'm Michael Kristoff.
I'm Anna Muskie-Goldwyn.
I'm Anthony Barquette.
And three things are clear. Anna's an overachiever. Anthony can't do math. And
nope.
I did not prepare a cold open today. So we just wung it. But
shows.
We're here.
Shows. It shows. I think it's winged shows. It. I don't think it's wung it.
We wunged it. No, we didn't wung it. We winged it.
Wow.
We winged it.
Wow.
So everyone take a drink. Everyone
now
take
it's
a
clear.
Drink.
Take a drink. Now it's clear I can't speak. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
What are we
what
drinking?
Are we drinking?
What's on our mind?
And what's on your mind?
And what's on your mind? You know, you go first.
And what's on your
mind? You go.
Fine, I'll go. I'm drinking some red wine that is aerated with this special little tool we got that's like a thing you stick in the wine and then it like squirts out the wine and it aerates.
Must be so nice to have an aerator.
Oh my God. Engagement gifts?
No, whoa. This is we've had this for a while. What's
Anthony
on my
and I
mind?
Have something actually, coming in the mail.
I yes. hope so. It's been 4 months. Yeah. No, what's on my mind is actually specifically for Michael today.
Oh, uh-oh.
I heard an interview. Do you know who has a book coming out?
A lot of people.
Maybe that you would be like particularly excited about.
Oh, man. Okay. Now I got to really
like
think.
In the topic of political playlists.
Mitt Romney has a book. Seth Moulton. Oh, Adam Kinzinger has a book coming out. Yeah.
I was listening to an interview with him.
Okay.
So PSA, if you guys don't know who Adam Kinzinger is, he was one of the OG political playlist politicians we covered. He was a Republican from Illinois. He ended up really turning against Trump, was on the January 6th committee, one of the only two Republicans with Liz Cheney, decided not to run for re-election, which basically he would have been doomed in the primary anyway, but has since become a national Republican voice very against Trump. And he's writing a book about all of it.
Yeah, we should get him on the pod. I bet we could get him maybe because of the book tour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thinking like a book.
Yeah. All right, let's do it.
All
Anthony,
right,
what's
next?
On your mind?
I'm drinking a martini, obviously.
Yeah.
And what's on my mind, I wanted to tell you guys a little bit of news. I went to a definitely not. Let's hope not. I went to a Halloween party this weekend and someone just reached out to one of my friends to write an article about my costume.
You're so cool.
I know. I'm so.
Wow.
You guys have had your bouts of fame, all right? I have had.
What was your costume?
Yeah, talk
about
your
costume. Explain your costume.
So my costume was a French bed bug. And by the way, if you don't know current events or news, then maybe you should Google this. But there was a French bedbug invasion in Paris around Paris Fashion Week, and supposedly they spread all
over. Is
that the
only
place.
French word you know, Mike?
Oui.
Merci beaucoup. So I was a French bedbug trying to come into American society. My welcome gifts was French baguettes and cigarettes.
That's
and
great.
My interests were mattresses and large beds.
Wow. It's so good.
I'm also interested in large beds.
We'll post a photo because the costume was really funny.
Yeah. So I thought I would always get in Forbes magazine for something, maybe like a Forbes 30 under 30, that passed. Maybe 40 under 40 would be my chance or just, you know, being on that list one day. But no, might be
this
for
be your
a, this is my chance.
They're like, who's a lovable idiot who went as a stupid costume this year that we could talk to? Anyone know anything?
Creative, not stupid. Creative.
I will say, Anthony does always have very creative costumes. I'm so bad at Halloween. I'm kind of jealous.
Yeah, for such a creative person.
Michael, I get all my creativity
what are you
out.
Wearing for Halloween and what are you drinking?
I went as Ken from Barbie and Ken.
Oh,
I
violated the SAG rules.
You also already did that.
Well, I had a Barbie and Ken party.
I know.
And then I still had the costume, so duh, no brainer.
It's like you can't.
It's like wearing a dress twice in a row.
Twice for a wedding. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I like to reuse. What with the world being in the state that it is, let's not go spend excess money on costumes we don't need. But here's what's on my mind, and I'm so sorry because I'm never the guy to sort of bring this to a more dramatic place. But
you aren't.
I have to take issue with a growing number of far left liberals who have decided to use the word genocide when it comes to Israel.
This is going to relate to my tweet. So,
oh, great. Okay. Well, this will be good. So, and forgive this being a little bit of a rant here, but we need to absolutely strike the usage of the word genocide from this conversation, because what Israel is doing is far from that. Genocide is when you take an innocent civilian and you behead them and you film that and post that, or when you take a hostage and you kill them. What genocide is not is when you strategically strike enemy combatants in a time of war after you've been attacked. And I think the tragedy of this whole situation is are the Palestinian people who are caught in the middle of this. And, you know, they are the tragedy and the horror of war is that innocent lives are sometimes lost. And we're seeing that on full display. But I think that this growing conversation on the left is failing. And I point to the failure of leaders. And I'm going to call out somebody like Rashida Tlaib and somebody like Ilhan Omar and other people like this who have a real platform, who could be speaking out on this and helping lead the conversation. And instead, I think that they are fanning the flames and they are actually exhibiting horrible leadership. And let me give some examples of that. So I think that they are completely downplaying and whitewashing the atrocities that Hamas has perpetrated here. I think they are absolutely conflating Palestine and the plight of the Palestinian people with the need to root out Hamas. Third, they aren't doing a goddamn thing when it comes to trying to actually take actionable tasks to help innocent Palestinian people. And what I mean by that is we have Egypt, we have Jordan, we have Lebanon, we have so many neighboring countries that surround this area that are Arab nations, and they are refusing to take Arab Palestinian refugees. They are refusing to let them in. They're refusing to help with aid. And if I am Ilhan Omar and I am Rashida Tlaib and I am others, I would join with my Jewish colleagues and say, we are going to lead on this front. We are going to lead on this conversation, and we are going to do everything we can to try and actually let these neighboring countries let in these refugees, help increase the amount of aid getting in there, and actually do something rather than perpetrating this bullshit narrative, which really we're seeing around the world to a scary degree. There's not a rise in anti-Islam. There's not a rise in people going after Arabs on the street. They're going after Jewish people on the street.
Okay, but also,
it's insane.
I think you have to be careful when you're saying that, though, because like there was the 6-year-old Palestinian boy who was stabbed to death by his landlord for being Palestinian. And I think that this is literally what my tweet is about. So I think we can parlay into this.
Okay.
I actually very much agree with you, but I think we have to be careful when we say that like this is all about the rise of anti-Semitism. I think the reason there isn't a rise in Islamophobia is because Islamophobia is already so proliferated throughout Western society. So I think that I agree with you. I think that genocide shouldn't be used. I think that apartheid also shouldn't be used. I think that that's another word that's being thrown around about this that is not correct. But well, I think, and I agree with you, but I think we have to also like understand that, yes, there's an insane rise in anti-Semitism, which is what I want to talk about, but to say that there is not also always so much Islamophobia in our Western societies, I think is a little bit ignorant to kind of like compare the two in that way.
I would push back on that. So obviously what happened with this innocent little boy is a disgrace and a tragedy and just absolutely horrendous. That's one incident. And we are every single day we're hearing about Russian Arabs storming an airport. You know, all of these things that just are cascading.
I agree with you. I'm just saying over time, Islamophobia has always been a problem. So I think that like we can't negate the fact that there has always been racism against people of Middle Eastern Arab descent. That has basically always been a part of our modern society.
Well,
so I don't disagree with you, but
there hasn't been this eradication, though. I really would take issue with this because I think that there's a real difference between Islamophobia and discrimination and an actual feeling of wanting to eradicate.
That's what we felt after 9/11. That's what happened to people in America.
Not really.
People were bombing mosques. Like, that's what was happening. So I agree with everything you're saying. I just think that, like, to negate what Muslim people, especially in America, felt in the same sentence as highlighting how fucked up it is with this current rise of anti-Semitism, I just think, like, both are true.
Yeah.
And they're different situations. But to say that one is true and not the other,
I'm not saying both are true. I'm saying one is way worse. I'm saying the anti-Semitism.
Right now.
I'm saying all the time, and we're just now finally being aware of it. Because I think this anti-Semitism has existed, you know, for well beyond the length that I've been alive, right? All we need to do is really look at the Holocaust in World War II, you know, for further evidence of that. And I think that, again, it goes back to, yes, there is anti-Muslim sentiment, there is Islamophobia, and that is very real. And I don't want to diminish any of the, you know, the fear or the trauma or the challenges that the Islamic community faces with regard to that. So I in no way am I marginalizing that. But I think that, to me, and again, I'm kind of an outside viewer in this, right? I'm a Catholic kid from Connecticut. So, you know, like I don't, you know, I sort of have like a higher level view of this from the standpoint of I'm not really on the ground. And it just seems to me that, you know, the extent to which anti-Semitism is fueling violence against that community is just to a different degree. And again, it's, you know, look, admittedly, it's hard to sort of compare who has a worse knife wound. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like a knife wound is a knife wound, you know?
Yeah.
So, hi, my name's Anthony. I'm.
Oh, hey, buddy.
Anthony, you got to learn how to just like get in there when Mike and I are yelling at each other. You're like a kid of divorced parents. You're just like sitting there like.
No, I actually, Michael, I think you said that very well. And I just want to dig in on the point that you both are arguing related to Islamophobia and this eradication. And I think what's really different is in the Islam faith, you have over 2 billion people in the world that are part mm-hmm. of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
In the Jewish faith, there are about six, I saw sent it's like 15 to 20 million people mm-hmm. worldwide, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you are talking about this eradication, it's the scary
it hits
part.
Harder.
Is
yeah.
It hits harder because it's way more possible. 2 billion people? Absolutely not. You know, 15, 20 million, that could, you know, unfortunately, that can be done somehow. And I think that's where really that knife gets deeper of what you guys are saying.
That's a good point. That's a great
very
point.
Good point. Can I read my tweet? Because this is like exactly what it's about.
Just take the stage.
And then we'll go back to some news highlights.
I'm also reading this as the only person here of Jewish descent. So that's, yeah, there was like a weird thing that I've been feeling where I'm like, I'm not Jewish, but I also have had moments in my life where I have felt like ancestral interest in certain things.
Yeah. What do you, I'm curious, really can I ask you a question about that? That like, you know, how do you, as somebody who is of Jewish descent, but you don't consider yourself Jewish or you're not, you don't practice the faith, you know, how do you feel having the conversation with people? Do you feel like you're an outsider to this or do you feel more of a connection to it?
I do feel like I'm an outsider to it for a couple of reasons. One, most Jewish people that I know have some sort of first or secondary connection to someone who lives in Israel. I don't have that. So I think that I don't feel that kind of like kinship with the physical nature of this. I also feel that I have never had to grapple with like my faith being offensive to another person. And look, maybe that's why like internally I kind of overcorrect in the other sense where I'm like, well, let's not forget the other oppressed people, right? Because I feel that I'm trying to like kind of balance out maybe my inherent sympathy for Jewish people based on my ancestral lineage, you know? But the thing that I do feel that I've felt when I've like celebrated Jewish holidays with friends and whatnot is a real kind of like a nostalgic connection to the ideas of Judaism and the idea of thinking about like my Jewish relatives who immigrated here and whose relatives remained in Europe and probably died in the Holocaust, that people that I will never know that I am distantly related to. So that's kind of the thing that's been on my mind is like, I don't feel that I can speak with any authority to this. And I very much have been deferring to my Jewish friends when it comes to like the emotion of it. But it is a weird thing where I'm like, oh, I kind of feel this odd connection because I feel that, you know, three generations ago or whatever, like that was my family who I, you know, will never know who they are. But, but yeah, I mean,
great,
I don't know. I
think
there's
answer.
A lot of people out there who feel that, right? Yeah. Who maybe are of Jewish descent who don't identify as such. And there's kind of an interesting like historical element to it, but not actually, I don't feel that I have any sort of authority on the subject. No. But this is my tweet. And I think this will kind of carry this conversation unless you guys want to talk about the news first. And then we
Let's roll into it.
So here we go.
This the news is
also
so depressing.
I mean, this is kind of the, So this is someone that we have not ever spoken about. So
oh, wow. Oh, my God.
But
let me get my cheat sheet. Hold on.
Yeah, here we go.
Be
my sheet.
Okay. I got it.
Oh, my God. You have it printed out. Amazing. So here we go. I am outraged by the recent threats aimed at Jewish students at Cornell. This is pure hatred on display. The administration at Cornell must immediately expel and make their identities known to the world. Cornell alumni and all freedom-loving Americans need to make their voices heard in this moment. We will not tolerate anti-Semitism in any form. Institutions like Cornell that promote, quote, safe spaces need to prove that they mean it when it comes to anti-Semitism and language reminiscent of the Holocaust. So quick background on what's happening in case you guys aren't aware.
Should we guess?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I forgot.
Nick Langworthy?
I guess the geography makes sense.
I was going to guess Anthony D'Esposito.
Well, you would have been wrong. Anthony
was, you were wrong. No problem.
So, yeah, Nick Langworthy, he's 42 years old.
I saw this story. This is kind of nuts.
It's nuts. So he's a 42-year-old representative from New York's 23rd District, which is very upstate, bordering Canada. And it's actually not the district that represents Cornell, but it's like right next to it. So my guess is he probably represents a lot of people that like work at Cornell and maybe have family in the area. He interestingly chairs the New York State Republican Committee, which I thought was interesting. But so about what he's talking about, basically there were anti-Semitic threats of violence to the Jewish community at Cornell and specifically to the people who live and go to the building where the Center for Jewish Living on campus is, which has like a kosher dining hall and is a gathering spot for students. And at Cornell, Jews make up 22% of the student body, which is a lot.
That's me.
Yeah.
That's wild.
So obviously taking this very seriously. So these threats were encouraging people to harm Jewish students. It was talking about shooting Jewish students at that particular building. So
and who was tweeting this? Who was saying this?
Nick Langworthy.
They haven't released it yet.
He implied that it's written on some of their message boards. He implied that it was a student. He was saying expel them, but like it hasn't been confirmed that it was a student. So I don't want to make any assumptions. But I want to kind of talk in sort of a larger scope about what is happening specifically at universities, which is kind of to your point that you were making earlier, Michael. Something that I saw today that I found very troubling was that at my alma mater at UCLA, there was a march, a pro-Palestine march, where people were chanting, resistance is justified when people are occupied, which I think the defense is like, we're not talking about the Hamas terrorist attacks. We're talking about the Palestinian people's right to, you know, resist the Israeli government. I just think that that's like really irresponsible for students to be chanting something like that. They gathered and, you know, I felt, it just made me think like, yes, students today are very educated. They're very online. They're very in the know of what's happening. But I remember being 21 years old, and you're so influenced by your surroundings, what your friends are saying, what's sort of happening on campus. Like, you're still in the process of creating your identity and creating your viewpoints. And so what I wanted to talk about is partially what Michael had brought up and this insane rise in anti-Semitism, but coupled with maybe the role that a politician like Nick Langworthy representing, you know, near a place where there has been one of these big anti-Semitic events, you know, he says institutions like Cornell that promote safe spaces, which to me felt like a dig at Democrats for saying, oh, like liberal universities making it safe for everybody now except Jewish people. And to your point about someone like Ilhan Omar not actually talking about the nuance of the situation, but maybe riling up people who don't have all the information. And so my question is really about, like, how do we get politicians to speak in a way that is helpful and speak in a way that is more about the good and the bad is innocent civilians versus terrorists, right? And I guess in some people's minds, the Israeli government is equated to terrorists. But even if that's your view, you can't say all Jewish people are representative of the Israeli government. And that's kind of, I think, to your point, Michael, the line that is beginning to be blurred.
Right, right. I think I would say a couple of things on this. I think the disgrace, in my view, and just the fundamentally inaccuracy of what we're seeing is that, you know, these student body organizations are having pro-Palestine marches, and they're not able to even condemn or seem to separate, you know, Hamas, which was elected by the Palestinian people, however much of a sham election that may have been, right? This is the governing body. So people aren't realizing that when the Gaza Health Administration puts out death statements, that's the terrorist organization telling you how many people are dead at the hospital that their bunker base is underneath, right? So everything coming out of Gaza is coming through the communication channels of a terrorist organization, right? So I think this is the first thing that our leaders need to start messaging with every megaphone that they have, right? Because I think we've talked about disinformation and the need for our leaders to be factual and accurate in their representation of their opinions and supportive of their opinions. And I think that starts with our leaders, particularly those like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who have the ear of these organizations, right, that would be on campus having a pro-Palestine march, helping everyone understand, first and foremost, everything you hear coming out of Gaza is coming through the Hamas communication channels.
It's exactly what they wanted to happen, because now it's going to turn more people against Israel. But
yeah, well, that's a good point, that this may have been the whole idea.
I mean, I think this whole college campus thing is pretty scary. I mean, when we went to college, I don't remember anything major like this happening.
There was, but it wasn't as like...
I remember like Osama bin Laden being killed.
Right.
There were celebrations,
you
know, and one thing I loved about college was walking on a campus and seeing so many different things being talked about or discussed. And I was like, wow, I never even knew that. This is a whole new level of hate, which is scary. And there's also been a lot of these polls coming out about Gen Z's that 50%, it's basically split between how they look at this.
Specifically how they look at Hamas.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, this is another sidebar about Gen Z, but they also don't want sex in movies going forward.
No, what? I read that article. Yeah.
No.
It was a whole article. Yeah.
So I don't want that.
Wait,
they
I'm sorry. Can we save that? Can we save that for our last call? Well, I want to have a longer discussion on that.
Okay. Well, or maybe another episode, but yeah.
I do think, though, there's fueling coming from various other groups here. I'm not giving these students any pause here of being on the hook, but I definitely believe there's groups that hate Jewish people who are walking to these campuses, saying they are Jewish, that they are students of the university, and saying something very bad about the Jewish population, you know, towards
yeah,
the Jewish
I mean, I think
population.
That the thing so that I just started having, to think about.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I think these people are joining a lot of these crowds, right? And granted, it's probably a mix of these people, yeah. but it's still happening on these campuses.
I mean, what was interesting, I was reading about the UCLA thing, and there was a professor who was like speaking at this. And
damn, wow, this would never happen at USC, by the way. But you know,
no,
that's why we're
we just pay our football players. That's it.
We just pay people off.
Come on,
yeah, because USC has too many Jewish people giving them money for their big ass.
That's
endowment.
True. That's true.
But yeah. no, but yeah. just to put a pin like a close on this, I think the thing that I just really started to think about is like one of the reasons that we started doing this is because we felt like there were politicians out there who specifically knew how to speak to our generation and knew how to communicate in a way that was not just palatable, but interesting to millennials and Gen Z voters. And what I think has been slightly disappointing in this particular situation is the things that I am seeing from these young politicians are not the most nuanced things that I'm seeing on social media are not coming from politicians. They're coming from activists. They're coming from people who have particular experience. They're, by the way, they're coming from like the parents of Jewish of Israeli hostages. Mm. Like the nuanced posts or videos or whatever are coming from elsewhere, not from these young politicians who I think have a real opportunity to draw the nuance and use communication skills to do so. And this was interesting because I agree with Representative Langworthy in his condemnation of this, of course, mm-hmm. but his last sentence and his use of posing it by saying like, oh, the liberal universities and their safe spaces, it's like, you're just stoking the fire. Like the reason that I think so many people are angry is because politicians have stoked a fire amongst all of us. And I think young people younger than us are specifically susceptible, not to say we aren't, but it just, I think it's something that people should be thinking about of like, where are you turning for nuanced information in this very complex and nuanced situation?
Can I just add something too to that? I thought that was very well said. And I want to just go back to the question you had asked, which is what can and should people be doing about this? And I think the question that people need to ask with this situation, who are feeling absolute heartbreak for the loss of life in Gaza, which, mm-hmm. you know, I can only imagine, you know, what my, and by the way, I have some very close friends who are Arab, and I can't imagine what they might be feeling with these images and videos that we're seeing coming out of Gaza. But I think what I would ask, or what I would encourage folks who are trying to support, you know, safety and freedom of the Palestinian people, I think the first question that they need to ask and that our leaders need to start leading the discussion on is, what does freedom for the Palestinian people look like, right? And I think that that begins with them not being ruled by a terrorist organization. So if step one is to root out the terrorist organization, then that's step one. And then step two is, what does a stable government in Palestine look like, right? And this is where, not to take this into a larger conversation of Israel needing to learn from the U.S.'s mistakes in Afghanistan and Iraq and quote-unquote empire building, the fact of the matter is that for the last 15-some-odd years, the people of Palestine have either allowed or have had no choice but to be led by Hamas. And so everybody in Gaza has either not been able to rise up against this authoritarian, you know, terrorist organization, or they haven't wanted to, right? And I think that that needs to really be a key focus of this, which is, how do you root out homegrown terrorism? And I don't know the answer to that.
I'm definitely not going to answer that, but maybe my tweet will go, because it's a little bit on this subject as well. And we don't have to go too much into detail, but I want to give anyone listening things that we should be, that we will be seeing with this new speaker. So, and it has to do with the subject.
Oh, well, this was my news item. So tell us, we have a speaker.
Well, we have a speaker, yes. But we talked about this with the whole situation happening. And one of my like top five things was I think Iran is going to be a major role in Congress going forward. Mm-hmm. So here's the
interesting.
Tweet. Joe Biden's failure to enforce sanctions in Tehran to help Hamas carry out their brutal terrorist attacks against Israel. I'm joining Representative Jim Banks in introducing the toughest Iran sanctions bill ever proposed by Congress. We must return to President Trump's maximum pressure campaign to hold Iran and its barbaric proxies in check.
Is it a new person or an
old person?
I was going to guess Jim Banks.
Dan Crenshaw.
High up.
Ooh. He's Stefanik.
At least. There we go.
Oh. Yeah,
this is a little too low there, Michael, again.
All right. Yeah, I was looking at the list again.
So what a lot of people are saying is this is one of the bills that they are going to be voting on very shortly. So only Republicans are behind this right now, but it's called the Maximum Pressure Act. So these are going to be the toughest sanctions ever proposed on Iran by Congress if it passes. It's also legislation prohibiting the Biden administration from lifting any sanctions until Iran stops supporting terrorists. So just a couple points here, but I want to ask you guys a question. This will declare that Iran was responsible for the Hamas war on Israel. It diverts the $6 billion that was sent to Iran to families of American terrorism victims, prohibits the Biden administration from lifting these sanctions on Iran and a couple others. But what I think is so interesting is I see a lot of these Hamas leaders are living in Qatar. Mm-hmm. And yet, like, Iran's been sort of the one who helped fund and behind this war. But also Qatar's the one in all of these negotiations.
The hostage negotiations.
But supposedly the Hamas leaders are all living in Qatar.
Right.
Well, yeah. What's interesting on that is that Qatar has actually been an incredibly faithful partner in a lot of our Middle East dealings. And so, you know, Qatar has a number of issues within itself. But one thing that, you know, again, just factually looking at the pattern of behavior, they have actually been an incredible partner to us. And so perhaps some of that is the fact that they are sort of condoning some of these Hamas leaders living there. And, you know, they're being an honest broker. You know, it's hard to say. But I do think that, you know, this question that you raise about Iran being now this sort of focal point, the focus of Congress's new boogeyman, so to speak, right? Political boogeyman. And I think what is interesting and what is being misleading and conflated here is that the $6 billion in funds that the U.S. released, we control that account. So we control that account, and we have designated that money can only be used for Iranian humanitarian efforts. So not a dime of that money had been spent prior to this Hamas attack. And so the U.S. government subsequently froze that account to look into Iran's, mm-hmm. you know, potential involvement in the Hamas terrorist attack. So I think this is a rather disingenuous and frankly, you know, a kind of shameless political ploy on the part of Republicans to try and obfuscate what an actual real solution looks like. You know, yes, Iran supports Hamas in past and in other ways, and yes, Iran supports Hezbollah in some ways, but there's larger issues at play there that I think are not being addressed by these political maneuvers, like we're going to bring a bill to the floor and slap the hardest sanctions on Iran.
Yeah, but just to like, I mean, I, yeah, of course there are other solutions, but I think the point Anthony made initially was a good one, which is like, this is now the country that has a target on its back in a revived way that we haven't seen for a minute. My question is like, and excuse me, this is an ignorant question, but Democrats don't want Iranian sanctions because they think that they're not humanitarian. Like, they think that basically we shouldn't be like poking the bear, so to speak, with Iran because they have nuclear weapons. Like, what is the why are Democrats against sanctions for Iran?
It's not that they're against sanctions. It's not that they're against sanctions. The biggest challenge and the political football with regard to Iran was the JCPOA, which was the Iranian nuclear deal. And when the Trump administration tore that up, Iran had been complying with the deal. Now, regardless of what you thought of the deal, the facts of the matter are that they had stopped enriching nuclear uranium. And so once that deal got torn up, they restarted their nuclear program. So the question becomes, with regard to Iran, do we want to create diplomatic relations with them insofar as to return or curb the nuclear program to where it was or curtail it? Or do we want to escalate tensions, which is what
The Democrat point of view is basically this sanction bill is escalating tensions in a way that is not helpful.
Correct. That's going to be counterproductive. That the worst thing we could do is to allow the Iranians. Yes, there are all these other issues that we have to deal with, but the worst thing we could do is let them fully enrich nuclear uranium. And so that is the view among many in the military community, many in the Democratic side of the political issues here. And so I think that's the real question is, you know, is all of this, you know, what's worse? What should we prioritize? You know, what do we do? And and I think the reality is that Iran is a very convenient political boogeyman, you know, as is China.
For sure.
In many ways. And so
but let's not forget the others here.
Right,
the thing,
right. Right.
All the bad men.
Yeah. Right, well, what's your tweet, Michael?
Oh, God. I'm sorry, guys. I got another depressing one. So great. I'm not going to have you guess because you've probably read this. And, you know, it's such a sad story going on that I think it just sort of bears a discussion and bears.
Oh, I already know what it is.
Yeah. And
it's Jared Golden, and it's about the Maine shooting.
Exactly. So, you know, Jared Golden of Maine.
Michael doesn't even have to say anything. I guess it is.
Exactly. It's like, yeah. You know, I watched The Shining last night.
Getting in the Halloween spirit.
And, you know, the whole thing, The Shining is like, hey, we have The Shining. We can, like, communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. So I feel like maybe we have The Shining and that you knew exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. Mm.
So Jared Golden, I want to give Jared Golden some real praise here because I think he did the unpopular thing and the difficult thing and the increasingly rarer thing in politics today, which is to stand up and admit I was wrong. And he owned up to his beliefs and his votes on this issue when it comes to assault weapons bans. So obviously, you know, everyone has now heard of the tragic shooting in Lewiston, Maine, which is Jared's district. 18 innocent unarmed people were killed with an assault rifle. And Jared stood up and he said, quote, "The time has now come for me to take responsibility for this failure, which is why I now call on the United States Congress to ban assault rifles like the one used by the sick perpetrator of this mass killing in my hometown." He asked for forgiveness and he promised to, quote, "work with any colleague to get this done." So what I think is really, you know, this is, I think, in many ways, a profile in courage, if we can have one in today's day and age, because this is a guy who he's a Marine veteran. He was multiple deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. He's probably maybe the most conservative Democrat, very in line with someone like a Joe Manchin, right? And he has previously voted against assault weapons bans. And now he is saying, listen, this was a failure. I now see that no community in America, no matter who you think you are, no matter where you think you live, you are no longer immune to gun violence. It can fucking happen anywhere. And that's the tragedy of it. And I think that it took real guts for somebody like Jared Golden to stand up and say, you know what? I was wrong. And I'm calling on my senators of this state, Susan Collins and Angus King, who both are also on the wrong side of this issue, in my opinion. They have voted against banning assault weapons. And now he's putting the pressure on these people. And so my question to you guys is, I'm not going to ask you if things are going to change tomorrow, because we know they're not. With pressure like this on two moderate conservatives, we'll call them, Angus King's an independent, usually caucuses with the Democrats, but clearly on the Republican side of this issue. Do you think that there's a chance, A, that Jared Golden and others can move Susan Collins and Angus King to the side of actually putting forth a assault weapons ban? And is this two more influential people in the Senate who could potentially be ticking those numbers a little bit higher to eventually get enough to say, yes, you know what, we're going to do something about this?
No, is my cynical answer. Because yeah, I think
hold on, let me refill.
Yeah, I already drank my martini.
Because I think that, and I'll try to answer this very quickly. There's a Republican-controlled House, which is never going to bring up an assault weapons ban bill for the next year and a half. Then there's a Democrat-controlled Senate, but I don't think that they're going to bring up an assault weapons ban bill because they would need some Republican support for it. I think that maybe there's a world in which Democrats, and if Biden keeps the White House and Democrats win back control of the House and retain control of the Senate, and Susan Collins and Angus King are still in their seats, and there is a bill that is brought by the House for an assault weapons ban that makes its way to the Senate, then maybe.
Okay,
but I don't think that this tragic shooting in their state is going to make them push them to make any public statement on that, because there's no legislation actually pushing their hand to do so.
Anthony?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just think it's sad. It's always whenever these major issues, incidents happen, is when, you know, people wake up and politicians wake up. And I mean, I think we're seeing this in so many instances, the Russian-Ukraine war, Israel-Hamas. You know, I feel that this, the largest mass shooting this year, hasn't gotten a lot of, and it's just sad to see. So especially to a town that's so small and rocked, that more people aren't going, oh shit, this can happen here as well. So,
yeah.
I mean, I was in Brussels when that terrorist attack happened. The guy had a AR-15 as well, I believe. And he could have easily gone to the square and just gunned down 100 people. Yeah. It's, you know, everyone's in this major tourist section, and it's scary to think about.
Yeah.
So,
man.
Well, my last call for this episode is that I think people need to take a step back, like do something happy. I was literally on a walk this morning. I was like walking my dogs like 7 a.m. And I was like, oh my God, like it's just like there's just to what Anthony said of like there was this insane mass shooting and it was like not the headline, you know?
Yeah.
And or vice versa, that like, you know, thousands of children are dying in Palestine and it wasn't the headline because there was a shooting on home turf. And so yeah, I don't know. My last call is maybe just to like take a second and see like your immediate world and try to have some solace in that, because I think that like this is just such a fucking difficult moment. And I don't know, we deserve better. Like good people deserve better, but we're not getting it and we're not going to get it for a minute. So
I enjoy the small things.
Do you have a last call? Because I have one that kind of relates to that.
No, I'll let you go.
Okay. Well, I would echo that, Anna. And I would say, you know, my last call is kind of a maybe a little more of a voter PM, but also a sort of here's the reality of what we're talking about.
By the way, it is election week.
It is. I know. So. I know. And this is my point is that we have, you know, elections coming up for municipalities and whatnot. Next Wednesday, November 8th, is the third and final Republican national debate for the Republican primaries leading up to the Iowa caucus. And I would say two points on that. One, I think everybody should really look at Nikki Haley.
I think there is surging in the polls.
There's a real momentum. And I think every Republican friend who I talk to who is not a, you know, a very big Trump supporter, which admittedly seems to be less and less of my Republican friends. Many of them seem to be desperate for an alternative. So I think Nikki Haley is somebody who really has an opportunity in front of her, and it'll be interesting to see what she does. And the second thing, which is the broader point, like it or not, we are a two-party system. And as you said, that, you know, you got to just take those moments to enjoy the happy, because it doesn't seem like it's getting better anytime soon. And I think the reality is that we are likely going to have two nominees in Biden and Trump, and that's going to be the decision. And my PSA to everybody is that, first of all, your vote counts. And second of all, there are only two choices. However much we might despise that, however much we might antagonize over that, and however much we might really have to drink a bottle of tequila before we cast our vote, hate both options.
Always, reality, every election.
The reality in our country is that we are a two-party system. And if you do not vote for one of the two major party candidates, your vote, as the data shows, tends to go to the Republican nominee. And so this isn't me saying to vote for any one or the other. I'm saying that you need to truly choose Republican or Democrat in this election, because if you don't, that vote is actually a vote for, more likely than not, the Republican ticket, whoever that might be. And so I really stress that the reality of our system, like it or not, is we are a two-party system, and you have to choose A or B. There is no C, there is no D, and there is no option to not vote.